The man with the plan, Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner.
Enormous damage has been done as a consequence of a long period of excess risk-taking without meaningful adult supervision. And the consequences of that are tragic because they're basically fundamentally unfair.
Timothy Geithner declares himself to be the adult in a financial playground where no one is having any fun.
Enormous damage has been done. Excess risk-taking without meaningful adult supervision. Meaningful adult supervision. Meaningful adult supervision.
Geithner tells the banks to line up. Recess is over on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Tuesday, March 24th. Coming up this hour, we'll talk about investor confidence in light of yesterday's rally on Wall Street, and we'll take a look at how fewer Americans are getting enough vitamin D. And we speak with a former member of the militant group, The Weathermen. Those stories coming up, but we have headlines. President Obama's first primetime news conference focuses on the economy, and his second one is expected to as well. It takes place tonight. He said yesterday that a new plan to buy toxic debt is just one part of his economic strategy.
The good news is that we have one more critical element in our recovery, but we've still got a long way to go, and we've got a lot of work to do.
More details expected this evening about the president's $3.6 trillion budget. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner and Fed Chair Ben Bernanke will talk economic strategy on Capitol Hill today. They'll testify before Congress, where they're expected to push for more financial regulation. Mark Garrison, can you top that?
Good morning, John. Let's talk AIG. New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo says employees have committed to return about $50 million worth of the controversial bonuses, but he hopes that's not the end of it.
I think it might be possible to recoup at the end of the process approximately $80 million, which would be approximately half the amount and the amount received by Americans.
Some AIG staffers are going further. A spokesperson for the company says several top executives have resigned and more resignations are likely to come. Israeli police have used tear gas and stun grenades to disperse fighting between far-right activists and Arab Israelis. The dispute began when activists marched through an Arab town demanding residents show loyalty to the state. The fighting comes as Israeli Prime Minister-designate Benjamin Netanyahu works on a coalition deal with the Labor Party. A labor official told Israeli Army Radio that they have reached a tentative deal to join the government. President Obama will host Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd today. The leaders are expected to discuss Afghanistan. The president is pushing for more international help with the war there, but Rudd has said Australia is unlikely to increase its troop presence. John?
And more about Afghanistan later on this week. The Dow and S&P both went up around 7% yesterday. The Dow closed at 77.76. The S&P made it past the 800 mark yesterday to close at 823, and that's where it begins trading today. So is it a financial sign of spring, or do you prefer more conventional signs of spring, for instance, like skiing?
Michael, on my way up to ski country in New England. Magnolias, I guess, officially say that I need to hang my skis up.
Don't look for the bottom in the market. Look for signs of spring. 5 days into spring, what's your favorite sign? Crocuses, daffodils, tulips, all welcome at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. We've turned the corner, folks.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. On a chilly morning in New York, well, maybe Wall Street investors are standing on the beach in their swimsuits, but most people around the world are carefully digesting the market information that came out of the Treasury Secretary yesterday, a bank bailout plan that may save the banks and may unfreeze the credit markets. So Wall Street exploded in a positive response, but Asian markets are mixed, and on the European markets, they're basically not showing any increase at all. A roar by the markets, what do we call it?
The plan was a detailed, smart plan to move us out of this economic doldrum that we're in.
I think this plan's going to take off.
I have complete confidence.
Confidence, confidence, confidence that things will get better.
Confidence is 90% of this game.
In fact, confidence is 110% of this game. The little montage about confidence is certainly setting off the theme that everyone is looking for this morning, including our guest, Kelly Evans, economics reporter for The Wall Street Journal, right here in the studio. Kelly, good morning.
Good morning.
And Juliana Liu, BBC Asia business reporter in Singapore. Juliana, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
First of all, let's just see if Asia continued the rally. 7% was what we had here on Wall Street, both in the S&P and the Dow Jones Industrial Average. What happened in Asia?
Well, Asia did continue the rally, but it wasn't quite to the standards of Wall Street. Now, two of Asia's biggest bourses, the Nikkei and Hang Seng, closed. They both closed 3.3% higher. Now, these are about 10-week highs. Although most of the fund managers I've talked to today say that it is more because it is spring and we are due for a rally rather than this plan.
So, and we're asking everyone for signs of spring or signs of economic, resurgence, I guess we would call it. Juliana, your report there suggests that there is wariness around the world at looking at these Wall Street numbers. Kelly, how do we distinguish between volatility on the uptick yesterday versus some real confidence in the plan that was outlined by Timothy Geithner yesterday? And I want to get into the details of that in a moment.
Sure. Well, I think if you look at the markets and confidence, what we saw was more their reaction to confidence in the fall. When Geithner was first named as Treasury Secretary, remember, there was a huge rally. They thought it was a very good sign. But then they got sort of past the sign phase to the, okay, now we want a real solution. And that's why when he sort of failed to be very specific earlier in the last couple of weeks with the plan, the markets really tanked on that. So I would say their reaction yesterday is more to the specifics, but the fact that the rally was so big and so huge, I mean, we're used to seeing these kind of moves on the downside. So to see it on the upside, I think is sort of reflects the kind of environment we're in now where people are sort of saying, well, wait a minute, geez, you know, I should have gotten in when the Dow was at 6,300. Look at it now.
Well, in fact, editorially, we wanted to ignore the market numbers yesterday, thinking that any reaction would just be noise as opposed to a real signal. But 7% suddenly makes us look at that again. And I guess the question is, in this plan announced yesterday, it's sort of a plan C. We've had a couple of versions of what's going to bail out the banks. It appears that it's the combination of public money in the form of FDIC funds and Treasury funds from the TARP, plus an estimate that they can raise perhaps as much as $330 billion from private sources to pull so-called questionable toxic assets off the books of the banks and get them to lend again. First of all, Kelly, that's a high bar, $300 billion of private money. And Juliana, when we come to you, how are Asian markets viewing that private sector money? Because a lot of it's going to be coming from Asia. First, Kelly.
Yeah, well, you just look at what investors are saying, and it's less. What's curious about this is the structure that this model is based on, which is that you take a certain amount of money, public and private, and leverage it to buy a lot of assets and clear them off these banks' balance sheets. There's sort of a wide gap between what investors are likely to pay for these assets and what these banks are going to want to sell them for. So we still haven't really figured out their true price. We don't know if it's just a matter of more money and more confidence and more lending to get these things cleared off the books at a reasonable number of cents on the dollar, or if they're sort of going to be these undervalued assets forever.
Juliana, is the private money going to lead here? Is Asian private money in these sorts of investments going to ultimately set the price for these questionable assets, do you think?
John, I have to add that Asia is very skeptical about this plan. I mean, these are toxic assets. They may lose some of their value if the recession deepens. I mean, there are a number of reasons why people here are not clear enough about the details to be really able to say. But also, don't forget, Asia, specifically, being based in Singapore, there are two government funds that have lost billions of dollars, tens of billions of dollars in the last 6 months. Now, these are reserves, people's money that they've been saving for 40 years here in Singapore, at least. China also has a lot of money. That money hasn't been building for as long as it has here in Singapore. But there's a lot of skepticism among governments and funds.
Skepticism and pain from losses. But I'm wondering, Kelly, if this is sort of the only game in town, and if this investment spread, if this opportunity that the Treasury is offering is kind of the only place to really find refuge from all the volatility in the market, are they going to benefit anyway, regardless of the skepticism?
Well, I also think this is just one cog in this sort of overhaul of the financial system, because, again, you have the Federal Reserve doing its part to inject, you know, hundreds of billions, $1 trillion into the economy to get things moving. And, you know, but there, it isn't just at this point about the banks and about the financial markets. We are seeing some signals from the broader economy that things that consumers, that everyday Americans are beginning to get more hopeful as well. Retail sales in January and February were above expectations. Yesterday, we saw that home sales had their biggest one-month gain in 5 years.
But that's a blip, don't you think?
It is a blip. But you know what? I'm so used. I cover this stuff every day, and I spent so much of January and February watching the things get worse and worse and worse. Just, you know, as fourth quarter data rolled in, that just to see a stabilization or a pop, to me, is everything.
Well, and you know, it is the case that for the first time, my wife and I actually this weekend looked at the sales. We actually went out and did some shopping, which we hadn't done for probably 4 or 5 months. So,
absolutely.
You know, if I'm any sort of an indicator, I'm a sign of spring myself. So, Juliana, if the Fed and the Treasury cannot raise $300 billion in private sector money to support this plan, does that say to the Asian markets, you can't do it, you can't get over the bar?
Yeah, it does. I have to add that for me, being based in Southeast Asia, I'm not really seeing any signs of spring at all. You know, these are numbers that you and Kelly are talking about. But for workers here, I mean, I spent yesterday in Malaysia, where tens of millions of Bangladeshi workers basically pay years of money that they make just to be able to get a job, you know, in a relatively richer country like Malaysia. And these guys are being abandoned by the people who brought them over because they simply are no jobs for them to do. So I'm really not seeing, you know, any of these signs of optimism being actually translated into more jobs for people, you know, half a world away.
A great point. I mean, in fact, we do focus on these numbers at our peril. It is an up-down kind of a volatility game. Kelly?
I will just say, though, that the labor market is one of the last areas that recovers in any downturn, in any recession. And if you look at the last couple in the U.S., it took 12 to 18 months for unemployment to fall back to its levels before the recession. So what we're talking about, again, agreed, isn't saying that, oh my gosh, look, people, the labor market's fantastic and you can go get a great job tomorrow. But what we are saying is that if we're looking for signs of progression, if we're looking for signs that the depths of this recession are sort of moving along, I would say I will happily take these signs compared to some of the numbers that we've seen, you know, sort of more in the fall and earlier this year.
Well, let's pull the recession issue out of it for a moment. Does this save the banks, Kelly? And then Juliana, we'll let you get the last word here.
The plan for these banks right now is absolutely what the markets were looking for. I think that alone will do as much for confidence and help the economy over the next couple months as anything right now.
Juliana?
Well, the fund managers here in Hong Kong and Singapore say that this is a classic bear market rally, that in the last 2 months or so we've smashed through so many levels on the low side that it's simply time for a rally. And you can see that in Asia, you know, it was the markets were at maximum going 3.5%, 3.3% higher. And we're not expecting a massive rally tomorrow. So on the market side, I think this rally is expected to fizzle.
And indeed, the futures are suggesting that there's going to be some profit taking this morning. All right, so forget the numbers, you guys. What's your favorite sign of spring, Juliana?
Well, in the tropics,
yeah,
there actually isn't a spring.
So you're safe. Kelly, how about you?
I was going to say here in New York, I'll just take the sun and temperatures that aren't 40 and windy.
Yeah, well, we've got wind and very cold temperatures today. Kelly Evans, thanks so much. Economics reporter for The Wall Street Journal here in the studio. And Juliana Liu, BBC Asia business reporter in Singapore. Juliana, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So 26 degrees here in New York. Yes, it's very cold. Signs of spring are difficult to find, but tell us your favorite at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Is it flowers or is it financial? Have we hit the bottom? Turn it around. Call a bottom. If not for the market, then just for winter. 5 days into spring. Give us a sign, someone.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
There are many rites of spring, not all of them written by Stravinsky. We're looking for your favorite signs of spring. How do you know spring's on its way?
My favorite sign of spring is a well-tuned rumble of a Harley-Davidson hitting the roads for the first time in the year. Thanks.
That's a good one. Tell us your signs of spring at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. And if you prefer financial signs, give us those as well. 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. So in the era of Barack Obama, and after an election campaign like no other in certainly my lifetime, the question of what is the role of protest in America today is finely tuned. Barack Obama described his ascendancy to the White House as the result of a movement. But protest in America and around the world continues. People are gathering in the United Kingdom to protest the G20 meeting that's coming up early next month. Mark Rudd was one of the leaders of the student anti-war movement of the 1960s here in the United States. He participated in the dramatic occupation of several buildings at Columbia University in New York to protest the Vietnam War and what students saw as racist university policies. He was one of the founders of the Weathermen, a group committed to the violent overthrow of the United States government. And he went underground in the 1970s and spent many years underground, finally writing his memoir, Underground, My Life with the SDS and the Weathermen. And he joins me now in the studio. Mark, first of all, good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for having me on the show.
It's great to have you here because it seems to me your experience, and I want to get into the details of that, really tell a tale about the role of protest in a democratic society, both in terms of the positives and the negatives. And, you know, it seems like you've learned a lot in your lifetime, and hopefully in the limited time that we have, we can learn from you. First of all, let's get the sound of your voice back in 1969. This is Mark Rudd talking about the system that will be overthrown.
This system is going to be overthrown. It's going to mean a fight. And it's going to mean a lot of white people risking a lot of things when they finally join on the side of the black people and the people of Vietnam and around the world who have already begun the fight.
How old were you when you said that?
Probably 20 years old.
And at that point, the mission was to get America out of Vietnam, to bring racial justice to reality in the United States. This was 1969. How were you going to accomplish that?
Well, I think that our branch of the anti-war movement considered the war in Vietnam and racism of aspects as aspects of a much deeper problem. We called ourselves anti-imperialist because we thought that the United States was an empire in the world. In fact, I think we were right about that.
And indeed, that debate was going on. Martin Luther King embraced the anti-war movement, and that was controversial in the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King Jr. And indeed, Malcolm X was very much talking about, is nonviolent protest more appropriate or violent protest more of a way to bring about change? You were in the middle of that debate as well?
Oh, absolutely. As white people, we tended to our group, or rather our faction of SDS, tended toward being very supportive of the Black Power branch of the Black Freedom Movement, and which was the development after the era of integration and Martin Luther King.
And images and slogans very frightening to white America. And I think you deliberately were looking to intimidate and frighten to create change.
Well, I think we kind of slipped into the realm of politics of transgression, mm-hmm. you know, and kind of being as bad as possible. We were kids. We had left our roots in the civil rights organizing and the anti-war organizing and kind of moved into something much darker at a certain period.
Three of your colleagues died when pipe bombs blew up prematurely, pipe bombs that were intended for targets that could have resulted in the loss of human life.
Right.
Is that something you regret?
Oh, absolutely.
Why were you pushed to go down that path?
Well, I think we had an idea. Part of the problem was how you think yourself into a corner. You know, you develop a set of ideas around the imminence of violent revolution in the world, including in this country, we wanted to support it. We wanted to support the world revolutionary movement. Che Guevara mm-hmm. had talked about create 2-3 many Vietnams. So we kind of thought ourselves into this necessity for violent revolution. That was the darker side, that part that you mentioned.
You describe, and this is something that you teach to students today, and you're a retired math teacher from the University of New Mexico, is that correct?
Well, actually, a community college.
Community college, right.
Central New Mexico Community
Central
College.
Central New Mexico Community College. That there's a difference between protest that is intended to be organizing a broad movement and protest that is for something you describe as self-expression.
I think you've got it exactly. During the period, in the first part of the book, I talk about a 3-year period that I was involved in that led up to the Columbia strike of 1968. And that was straight out organizing, meaning base building, coalition
right.
building. Everything that actually I had learned from people who had been involved in the civil rights movement and the labor movement. That's a very traditional model and very effective. In fact, ultimately, that's the model that Barack Obama
right,
used.
Right.
But then we got into demonstrating our own militancy and our own desire for revolution and our own feelings about the great tragedy that the United States had imposed on Vietnam. And that was self-expression.
And you wouldn't vote. You were angry and embarrassed about your sense of white privilege as part of being the draft deferred, easily obtainable draft deferment in
well,
Vietnam.
Well, I think we identified a system of privilege in this country, which still exists.
Right, right. When did you decide to come in from the cold and how?
1977. I had actually become inactive in the Weather Underground, but I was still a fugitive for 7.5 years, from 1970 to 1977. That was the first year of the Carter administration. And the country wanted to forget Vietnam, Watergate, and it was a good time to come in.
What's the role of protest in this era, do you think?
Oh,
and thinking about the G20 and the concerns for the economy right now?
Well, I think that this, we're blessed right now with an opening because of the crash of the free market militarists who were in power. The opening basically is that if we can develop a large enough mass movement, then we can push towards what we need, which is basically to restrict the power and the money going to the military and put it to domestic uses.
Well, questions for today, and it's a great read, a great memoir. Mark Rudd, author of Underground, My Life with the SDS and the Weathermen. Thanks so much for joining us, Mark.
Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. The challenge of getting enough vitamin D. When we come back after headlines, with Mark Garrison in for Femi Okay.
Thank you. Coming up on 33 minutes after the hour, the escalating violence in Afghanistan will be on the table when President Barack Obama meets Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd later today. The two essentially agree on pulling troops from Iraq. Both support fighting climate change, but troop levels in Afghanistan may be less of a consensus. The president has committed to sending thousands more U.S. troops there. Rudd faces opposition back home to sending more Australian soldiers. Israeli police have intervened in a clash between Arab Israeli youth and Israeli far-right activists today. The activists marched through a majority Arab town in northern Israel. They demanded residents take loyalty oaths to Israel, something the far-right party there has called for. That same party has agreed to join the next government led by conservative Benjamin Netanyahu. Later today, the center-left party will vote on whether to join it as well. A blizzard is sweeping through the West today. Blizzard conditions have shut down hundreds of miles of interstate across Wyoming and the Plains states. There's heavy snow, bitter cold, and wind gusts of more than 60 miles an hour. A new study, the largest of its kind, links eating red or processed meat with decreased health. The National Cancer Institute says the rate of cancer and heart disease spikes for older Americans whose diet includes significant red or processed meat being like bacon or pepperoni, that kind of thing.
Hot dogs.
Yeah, hot dogs as well, or hot dogs wrapped with bacon. Mm. Dr. Rashmi Sinha is a senior researcher at the Institute. He says the finding is significant.
It supports the recommendation that the American Institute for Cancer Research and World Cancer Research Fund, and as well as Cancer Society, has recommended that we should limit the intake of red and processed meat.
Now, beef and pork producers, they're pushing back. They say the results are flawed because it focuses on people who eat extreme amounts of red meat. The test amount was about equivalent to a quarter pound of hamburger a day.
So that's a Whopper a day.
Not quite a Whopper, a little less than a Whopper.
Right. So daily red meat, bad for you. That's the study.
In some sense, yeah, for older Americans, other kinds.
I just wanted to get that clear. Thank you, Mark.
But delicious.
But delicious, yes. So you may not be aware of this, but one of the other great dramas of life on planet Earth that doesn't involve red meat, but when fish schlepped themselves out of the ocean and began to live on dry land, they had a problem. The great challenge of organisms with backbones living on dry land was how to get vitamin D into their system. Most of us evolved to do it with sunlight. Reptiles are very, very good at it. Mammals, not so good at it. But a report out on Monday in the Archives of Internal Medicine says that between 1994 and 2004, Americans were slipping in their vitamin D uptake than in previous years. And perhaps Americans are getting less vitamin D than they need. Joining us to discuss the significance of both the vitamin and the results in this new study is Gabriel Glazer, a freelance journalist and author. Gabriel, good morning.
Good morning.
Vitamin D is an unusual sort of creature in our metabolism. First of all, explain what we use it for and why it's different from, say, vitamin C and other more easily metabolizable and available vitamins.
Well, we used to use it, or people used to think that it was used only to protect us against bone disease. It was first discovered as something called the sunshine vitamin when kids started going indoors during industrialization and got rickets. And doctors learned that when children went back outside in sanitariums, they suddenly got better. And slowly over time, we learned that it helped protect against bone disease. But in recent years, we've come up with all sorts of advances in medicine that show us that vitamin D, which is actually not technically a vitamin, it's a hormone, is really important in protecting us against all sorts of diseases, and it's responsible for the regulation of about 1,000 human genes.
Now, what does this report show in terms of deficiencies, and what kind of health implications are there likely to be as a result?
Well, it's a very, very striking study. It shows that 3/4 of Americans are now deficient in vitamin D, and that's just in the last 10 years. Not that this is anything to brag about, but in 1994, half of Americans were deficient. So that's a big, big jump. And it's particularly significant for people with darker skin. The darker the skin, the more difficult it is to absorb vitamin D when you go into the sun. That's how the body makes vitamin D. You go into the sun hits your skin, and it goes through a process of manufacturing vitamin D, this hormone.
Now, the complexity of that process interacting with the sun plus the complexity of the molecule, it's a hormone. It's not an antioxidant like, say, vitamin C.
Exactly.
Right. So you can't necessarily supplement with pills to get vitamin D reliably. It's a little more tricky.
Exactly. You can get vitamin D at a health food store, at a reliable vitamin manufacturer.
Right.
And some people are saying that you should be taking. We really need to increase our intake of vitamin D, or the actual international units of them, to about at least 1,000 international units a day. At the moment, the recommendations are 200, which is a lot of people say that's a joke.
Now, over the long term, if Americans are deficient, then now that you're mentioning it, it seems to me that if we use more sunblock, that may actually impede our ability to absorb vitamin D. Don't know if that's true or not, but if we maintain these deficiencies, what are the health consequences?
The health consequences are quite serious, actually. It's been implicated just last month. British researchers found that it was responsible, vitamin D deficiency was responsible for turning on the gene that can cause MS. There are researchers looking at vitamin D and diabetes, vitamin D deficiency and asthma, vitamin D deficiencies in all sorts of cancers, depression, and
inability to remember things?
Yeah, inability. Exactly. I must be deficient myself.
Yeah, there we go. So, but seriously, the range of health impacts is not because we don't know much. It's because of the complexity of the molecule. Again, the more complex a molecule is, the more it interacts with all kinds of varieties of health processes.
Precisely. And 20 years ago, here's the most important thing. 20 years ago, doctors decided that we really needed to protect our skin and stop going out in the sun. So in the last 20 years, we have listened to that information. We want to protect our skin from melanoma. And we've stayed inside more. Furthermore, we've gotten much heavier and we drink a lot less milk, which is fortified with vitamin D. Hmm.
So what's the recommendation then? Go out in the sun more, but sort of monitor your skin cancer potential?
Exactly.
I mean, it is a trade-off.
Nobody is telling you go out on tinfoil with your baby oil like, you know, everybody did in the 70s. But certainly it's okay to go out for 15 minutes a day. Maybe you want to protect your face, but expose your arms, expose your legs, and certainly try to get vitamin D, good vitamin D supplements. It's also, you can get it in a couple of foods, egg yolks, salmon, sardines, but we don't consume too many of those.
True. But baby oil and tinfoil, I haven't heard that since the 70s. Fish, of course, are very good at getting vitamin D on their own. Gabriel Glaser, freelance journalist and author, talking about the inability of humans to easily acquire vitamin D without hanging out in the sun or increasing their consumption of it. It's a study that came out yesterday in the Archives of Internal Medicine. Between 1994 and 2004, Americans actually started getting less vitamin D. Gabriel, thanks so much.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Joining us now is Linda Blake, freelance TV and radio reporter in Mumbai, India. Linda, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. Now, the Tata was, or the Nano was released officially yesterday. Tata, the big car company in India, rolled out the Nano. It's supposedly the cheapest mass-produced car in the world. Does it fit in your wallet, Linda?
Fit in an office cubicle. This thing is pretty much less than a laptop computer. We're looking at about $2,000. It's billed as the common man's car, the people's car, and really what it's become in India is the Rolex of cars, or the iPhone, or the Jordans, in that you park it in front of your house and prove to the world that you're pretty much worth something, that you too have a car.
Now, what is it about this car that might be distinguished from, say, a Volkswagen Bug or a Ford Pinto or, you know, little cheap cars of the past? The Yugo, for instance. I guess it actually runs, so it would be just different from the Yugo.
Well, it does have a rear engine. However, essentially, it's bling-free, so it needs a serious visit from the folks at MTV's Pimp My Ride, because basically no radio, no air con. There's one windshield wiper instead of two. There are three bolts on the wheels instead of four, so it's really makeshift, no airbags. And so ultimately, safety regulations are out the window, but it does ensure a cheaper selling price.
Now, for a place like India, where in Mumbai particularly, known for its dreadful traffic jams, is a proliferation of even small cars an idea that, that has merit, even if they are energy efficient?
Well, absolutely. It's been heavily criticized, though this car actually has a lower carbon footprint than most. The fact is, right now, only about 1% of Indians own cars. Now, if that matches the United States, we're looking at, in the U.S., not New York, but in the U.S., about 700 cars for every 1,000 people. So basically, if India matches that, they're gonna be, we're going to ultimately have double the total amount of cars on Earth. And, of course, that means double the pollution. So we're looking at a serious situation here.
And the media has taken that up. I mean, I guess the question is, do the people of India want cars in their own country, or is this something for export markets and that, you know, entails a level of prestige for the Tata Group?
Well, there's a want here, especially amongst the emerging middle class, no question about it. Now, Tata really hinted at the export market for sure. Last night at the launch, in fact, he mentioned several times that he would be framing it and presenting it to Europe in 2011, and he even hinted at the United States. He said, with the recession around the corner, very diplomatically, of course, he said, you know, this would be a good fit there, pretty much trying to lure potential buyers.
And within the next 3 years or so was at least the quote that I'm seeing. Any idea how much a Nano would cost?
Definitely not Nano prices in the States, but, you know, it'd be pretty chic to take it for a whirl around the block.
How many people can actually fit in a Nano? And I've been to India, and I've seen whole families of like six people piled on a bike, on a two-wheel scooter.
No question about it. Well, basically what it'll do is take those four people that are crunched atop a scooter and put them in essentially a similar-sized environment, but in a car. Now, I went and I kind of squished around, and I couldn't fully stretch out my feet sitting in the front and even in the back seat. I kind of had to cramp myself in, a little bit like the old folks who would cram themselves into a phone booth for fun in the early days.
So it's
That's pretty much what it feels like.
A small footprint, and it feels that way inside and out. Linda Blake, freelance TV and radio reporter, reporting on the Nano, the rollout by Tata of what's said to be the cheapest mass-produced car in the world. Thank you, Linda.
Thank you.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Coming up, some disturbing economic numbers, and I don't mean the Dow Jones Industrial Average, right after headlines from Mark Garrison.
Thank you, John. Coming up on 12 minutes before the hour, President Obama holds a primetime news conference tonight. It's his second while in office. White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs says it's part of administration efforts to keep the public in the loop.
Continued dialogue with the American people about where we are and where we're going is necessary, certainly in times like this.
Anything from bailouts to banks to budgets could come up. Yesterday, the president said a new plan to help banks get rid of their toxic assets is only one part of getting the economy moving again. That toxic asset buying spree has investors happy so far. The Dow went up nearly 7% yesterday. That's its biggest one-day rally in months. Asian stocks followed suit this morning, with the main indices for both Japan and Hong Kong up around 3%.
Although Europe kind of went ho-hum.
They're kind of in the middle like that. They had a little chance to respond yesterday, though. So today's their day two, we'll call it. But Mexico is offering big rewards for a capture of its most powerful drug lords. The country says it would pay up to $2 million each for information leading to the arrest of at least two dozen suspected cartel leaders. The announcement comes ahead of planned visits to Mexico by Secretary of State Clinton and President Obama. John.
Thank you, Mark. So the market numbers go up and down. Investors may look for a bottom in the market or see short-term trends in their investment patterns, but there are some long-term trends in the U.S. economy that are perhaps more relevant to what's going on socially in America today. If you hadn't already taken a look at these numbers, here's a splash of cold water for you. A recent analysis of the latest available data from 2007 show that the gap between the net worth of the typical African-American family and the typical white family is actually growing. We hear a lot about the difference between the super rich and the rest of America, but if you divide things racially, the numbers are, if anything, even more alarming. Meju Louie is the director of the Closing the Racial Wealth Gap Initiative at the Insight Center for Community Economic Development in Oakland, California. She is at a conference down in Washington, D.C. that's attempting to address this issue of the racial divide in the U.S. economy. Meju, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much, John.
Let's take a look at these statistics because they really are amazing. What is the gap, the income gap, between your typical African-American family and your typical white family in America?
Well, for every dollar owned by the typical white family, an African-American family only has 10 cents. So this is really quite a shocking number. I know that when we looked at it, we just couldn't believe it.
And let's just take it apart for a second. Let's take it apart. It's income and ownership of assets. Describe how that calculation is made, if you could.
No, this is not the income number. Income for African-Americans make almost 70 cents to the white dollar. That's still a big gap. That's only not even three quarters, but a dime for a dollar is amazing. Now, when we talk about assets, we mean both tangible and intangible financial assets. So, for example, the home equity that you have if you own a small business, but also things like simply savings accounts, retirement accounts, investments, everything in your portfolio.
So what is it that's working to widen this gap? Because the latest numbers, and again, this is from the Federal Reserve, right?
It is. It's the Survey of Consumer Finances, which is done every 3 years. Yes, so these are government numbers. Well, the wealth gap, you really have to look at history in order to understand why it is the way it is. So, you know, I like to say that income is like a snapshot, but in order to understand wealth, it's kind of like a movie, because what your parents have and what they're able to pass down to you makes a huge difference. And throughout United States history, our government has passed policies that have given boosts in wealth building to white families, and they have denied those same opportunities to families of color. So that's why we're in Washington, too. We're thinking that, well, policies created this gap, and policies can close them, so we really need to address it. But in terms of the recent growth, for one thing, as people know, that the home mortgage crisis really hit the black community perhaps the hardest of any, partly because they were more likely to be steered into those high-interest subprime loans than white families were, although many white families got caught up in it as well. So the loss of wealth recently through the foreclosure crisis, which started earlier, actually, than what some people say, you know, when the recession started, it actually started earlier in the black community.
What is the distribution of credit, do you think, racially? Is there a way of tracking how available credit is from one race to another, from one neighborhood to another?
Yes, we've also taken a look at some of those numbers, and the credit scoring system is completely crazy. Nobody really knows how it works. It's completely untransparent, and people of color routinely are given lower credit scores than whites, which means that they get, again, higher interest loans if they need them. If you are going to start a small business, for example, you're much more likely to have to use your credit card at a high interest rate than to get a prime loan to start that small business, which is at a reasonable interest rate, because your credit score is not as good. And this is really a bad thing for our economy as a whole, because we're not creating jobs fast enough. So we really need to have more people either self-employed or starting their own businesses. And those are the people that will spend the money in their own communities, hire other people from their communities, and really get this economy moving again from the bottom up.
And all of these statistics tell the story of inhibitions to wealth building for African American entrepreneurs and their families, that incrementally money is taken in the form of higher interest rates or not available credit or being steered into a high risk sort of mortgage portfolio. All of those things, not only do they have an impact on individual families, but they prevent wealth building at the much higher rate of whites, and that over time creates this gap and actually mitigates to or assists in widening it, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, the reason that we focus on wealth, too, is that it's not that we want everybody to be wealthy. A lot of people think of wealth and wealthy as the same thing, but it's not. We're talking about, like, if you only have income, you could just as soon call it outgo because it comes in and it goes out at the end of the month. You really need to have assets, and we're figuring that out right now because people are getting laid off. If you don't have that cushion, you won't be able to weather those rainy days. And not only that, you won't be able to sort of take charge of your own life and have economic mobility and security, which is really the American dream. So we're really denying the American dream to so many people right now.
So down in Washington, I guess the question really is, what are the policy considerations, Meju Louie, for people who are going to attempt to advocate to the Obama administration that something needs to be done here, either with the tax code or as we think about stimulus programs to deal with this income gap? I mean, the political worry, I would think, is that Barack Obama, the first African-American president, could preside over a widening of this very racial gap.
Yes, and that would be a real shame, and that's really what we are here to talk about. We want to say that, yes, we need to fix this economy. We need to pull everybody up. We don't want anybody to be living in poverty or to be experiencing downward mobility as so many people are. However, if you look at these numbers around wealth, we have two tasks. We have to close the overall inequality gap in our country, but we really have to address the racial gap because if we're posing as a democratic country, as a leader of the world in those ways, we have to show them that we are practicing what we preach at home. But even more than that, if we leave some people out of our economy can't grow. So here's a whole untapped resource. We really, people in communities of color have a lot of entrepreneurial energy. They want to jump into the economy. So if we can help them do that, this is not a time to leave anybody behind. This is a time when we need all hands on deck to really get this economy going.
Very quickly, is this about preferences economically, or is it about removing obstacles?
It's about removing obstacles, but it's about being very intentional and looking closely at what the numbers are all the time so that you don't unintentionally pass policies that widen the gap.
Well, and it is an enormous gap. Meju Louie, director of the Closing the Racial Wealth Gap Initiative at the Insight Center for Community Economic Development, explained that to us from Washington, D.C. Meju, thanks so much. So we're asking for you signs of spring, favorite signs of spring. We're 5 days in. One of you called and said a motorcycle on the street is a sign of spring.
My favorite sign of spring is a well-tuned rumble of a Harley-Davidson hitting the roads for the first time in the year.
So we played the sound of a Harley-Davidson. All right, listen to that. And then, of course, just a few minutes after that, we got a call from someone who said, uh-uh.
The sound bullet you just played of a motorcycle starting was not a Harley. Harley doesn't sound like a Japanese bike, which is what you were playing.
But the truth is, that was a Harley. It was the sound of a 2007 Harley-Davidson Sportster XL 1200. Next time, we'll choose something with the bigger rumble, you know, the V-twin. Oh, yeah. So what's your sign of spring? Listener Rebecca James writes, my sign of spring is seeing the finches turn from brown to yellow. That's a great one. Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Crocuses, daffodils. If you missed anything, we're always on here at The Takeaway. Take our podcast to go. Seeing people with their Takeaway podcasts to go is also a sign of spring. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
He plays one on TV.
You don't make much money betting against the Fed in the long run. He can't call the exact bottom. Even he, who has all the power in the world, can't call the exact bottom. But if he keeps flooding the economy with money, there will be a turn.
Actor, comedian, game show host, economist Ben Stein. I guess one of those makes him qualified to call a market bottom. The markets roar as the Fed hoses the world down with dollars. We're all wet with money or advice. Pick one on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. Tuesday, March 24th. Coming up this hour, we'll talk about what to expect from the hearings in Congress over the next few days on the budget. We'll also look at the NATO bombing of Serbia, which began 10 years ago today. And we'll find out why banks in Lebanon are actually thriving despite the global recession. First, headlines. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner banned cameras yesterday when he met with reporters to discuss his new plan to buy toxic debt from banks. But he'll be unable to avoid them today when he and Fed Chair Ben Bernanke testify before Congress. Geithner says the body needs to create more financial regulation.
Enormous damage has been done as a consequence of a long period of excess risk-taking without meaningful adult supervision. And the consequences of that are tragic because they're basically fundamentally unfair.
Finding meaningful adults on Capitol Hill will be a difficulty, and Geithner and Bernanke will also face questions about the AIG bonuses. Meanwhile, New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo is praising AIG employees who have agreed to return their bonuses.
I would like to say to the individuals who have given the money back, you have done the quote-unquote right thing. You've done what this country now needs and demands.
$50 million worth of the AIG bonus money has been returned so far. That's about a third of the total given out. Mark Garrison, what did I miss?
Good morning, John. President Obama is probably hoping to speak about something besides AIG during his primetime press conference tonight. He's expected to get questions on the federal budget and energy policy, probably plenty on AIG as well. Before that, the president will host Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd. The leaders are expected to discuss Afghanistan. The president is pushing for more international help with the war there, but Rudd has said Australia is unlikely to increase its troop presence. Overseas, Israeli police have used tear gas and stun grenades to disperse fighting between far-right activists and Arab Israelis. The dispute began when activists marched through an majority Arab town demanding that residents show loyalty to the State of Israel. The fighting comes as Israeli Prime Minister-designate Benjamin Netanyahu works on a coalition deal with the Labor Party. A Labor official has told Israeli media that they reached a deal to join the new government. The vote, though, to make it official doesn't start for about an hour.
And the issue of loyalty of Israeli Arabs was actually a big issue in the campaign, a divisive issue in the campaign, and it's interesting and disturbing that it's boiling over into some activity in the streets. Yeah,
set forth by the far right party that's going to be in this new government.
Indeed. So. The Dow and S&P both went up about 7% yesterday. The Dow begins trading at 77.76. The S&P went way over 800. It begins trading at 823 this morning. Forget about signs of a market bottom. What about spring? Signs of spring. What's your favorite sign of spring?
My first sign of spring that I see, I experienced this weekend. Landscapers. They wake you up at 6 a.m. on a Saturday morning while they cut the lawn, rake leaves, and otherwise disturb the quiet and peace that we had all winter.
Tell us your signs of spring at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. It seems hard to imagine, but 10 years ago today, the U.S. began bombing, NATO forces began bombing Serbia in a campaign, a war, over the territory of Kosovo. Kosovo is now its own nation. The legacy of that conflict 10 years on in a moment. But first, it's all about policy on Capitol Hill. As the markets sort of digest the bank plan announced by Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, members of Congress are deep into the weeds on the budget. Here's Senator Kent Conrad, Democrat from North Dakota.
I think people understand and appreciate that when you lose $2.3 trillion on a revenue forecast, you got to change the budget. And we have changed the budget.
Fear of deficits has changed the tone of members of Congress in thinking about the policy initiatives that Barack Obama proposed in his budget so recently. The deficits are all center stage. Here's Senator Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky.
This is extremely irresponsible, this recommendation. And I think that's why the president and vice president are having to come up here this week to try to settle down and to reassure Democratic senators who are privately looking at this exactly the way Senator Gregg and I are.
Joining us now is Todd Zwillick of Capital News Connection, our eyes and ears on Capitol Hill. This really looks like a serious policy pushback, Todd Zwillick, from both Democrats and Republicans, fear of deficits. Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong, John. Good morning. And there is pushback, and you're going to see evidence of it today. You heard from Kent Conrad. He's chairman of the Budget Committee. And today in the Democratic caucus, they have lunch every Tuesday. And today at lunch, he is set to unveil his budget resolution. Now, this is the Senate version. The White House sent up its budget, a couple of weeks ago, and we talked plenty about that. That was just their suggestion, their sort of push on Congress. Here's what the White House wants for its policy. Well, this is the actual congressional budget. And it's going to be pretty different in a lot of ways from what the president wants. You just talked about deficits. And the biggest difference in terms of deficit, the White House budget had deficits out to 5 years around $750 billion a year. That's about 4.3% of the economy. Conrad told us last evening that his budget resolution is going to be closer to $600 billion in year five. That's under 3% of the economy. So he is cutting. To do that, he needs to cut spending in the budget across the board from what Obama wanted. We'll see some more details on how he gets there today. But that's the big number, under 3% deficit, under 3% of GDP by the fifth year. That's a lot lower than the White House wanted.
Now, the policy implications of this seem a little bit confusing to me. It appears as though Democrats even have tabled much of what Barack Obama was talking about in his environmental policy, the elaborate cap and trade program that was unveiled with the budget message. And I'm wondering also about health care, which was a center stage policy implication in Barack Obama's budget.
Well, Conrad has said that the main White House priorities, health care, global warming, cap and trade, educational improvements and deficit reduction. Those are the four marquee parts of Obama's budget. He says those priorities are protected. Now, you can say that. We haven't seen the numbers yet. He says those priorities are protected. The thing called discretionary spending. This is the spending that Congress has control of year to year. Things that don't have to be spent, like Medicare, Social Security. That number has to go out the door according to formula. But other spending, discretionary spending, that's probably going to be cut in the budget across the board. There'll be savings there. How much they set aside for health care, how much they set aside for cap and trade and for education is one of the questions. Hopefully that will be answered by the end of the day today. Those policies we expect to still be in there, but there's lots of different ways to do cap and trade to set up that market that determines how much federal resources have to be put into it. And let me also point out real quickly, don't forget, this budget sets aside money for the committees to work with when they make the policy later in the year for big healthcare overhaul or big environmental overhaul. It's not the policy itself. So even if they get this budget passed, that doesn't mean we have a cap and trade system. It doesn't mean we have a healthcare overhaul. It just means they have the running room to make the policy.
It's the authorization versus the actual appropriation. Well, Barack Obama has a news conference tonight and is apparently going to go up to Capitol Hill and try to sell this tomorrow. Is there any leverage that the White House has, or is the Congress running the show at this point?
Well, the White House always has leverage. Now, the White House doesn't have a ton of leverage on the actual budget resolution, and it's for that exact reason. It's a resolution. The president doesn't get to sign it or veto it. This is all about Congress setting up its budget outlines and its budget parameters for the rest of the year for the appropriations process. But the president always has the bully pulpit. The president always has the most command of public opinion. He's out this week doing – the White House is out doing sort of health care kind of regional town meetings on health care overhaul. There's a reason they're doing it this week. It's because the White House wants $35 billion over 10 years for health care overhaul. They're out this week. That's a huge number. The country has sticker shock over the budget, over bailouts. And the president is out, will be making the point on Wednesday on the Hill, is making the point tonight on positive and making the point around the country. Yes, it's a big number, but we need to do big things because we have big problems. There's a reason why it's so big. It's not frivolous. This is why I want to do this. He has the command of that message. So yes, he has leverage, sure.
And at the very least, we're off the AIG bonus story. Todd Zwillick, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Todd Zwillick, Capital News Connection, our eyes and ears on Capitol Hill.
Oh, no. For all you need to know, go, go, Todd Zwillick.
So it's almost impossible to think back 10 years. But that was the day, 10 years ago today, NATO planes led by the United States began bombing Serbia. The airstrikes were aimed at forcing Serb troops out of Kosovo, then a province of Serbia where the majority wanted independence and were rebelling against Serb rule. In the middle of the Clinton administration, it was a foreign policy crisis that gripped the world. Liljana Smilovic, former editor of the Serbian daily newspaper Politika, joins us from Belgrade. First of all, Liljana, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
What is the legacy 10 years on of what was certainly the biggest challenge in foreign policy of the Clinton administration, but almost seems like a footnote today?
Well, the legacy has been eclipsed by the fact that a year ago, Kosovo was recognized by the United States and by practically all of the NATO countries that joined in the bombing of Serbia. So to Serbs, the bombing was bad enough. But now there's been insult added to injury because 10 years ago when the war ended, Serbia's sovereignty over Kosovo was still enshrined in the UN resolution that ended the conflict. Now that's gone away. That cover for the operation. So for Serbs, retroactively, 10 years ago, the bombing was only a prelude from taking away their territory from them.
And is the situation politically stable between Kosovo and Serbia, or do Serbians broadly believe that that territory will eventually be returned to Serbia?
I am not sure that Serbs believe it will be returned to them, but I think that they resent deeply all the countries that have recognized Kosovo. I saw today that Reuters said that the relations between Kosovo and Serbia are acrimonious, and that really is an understatement. But I think Serbs are resigned for the most part that they will never be present in Kosovo again as a sovereign country. What they are not resigned to is this sense of injustice and that they have been dealt a bad card by the international community.
Well, but what of the charges that motivated the war and the NATO airstrikes of ethnic cleansing, of a systematic policy on the part of Serbia to rewrite the borders and the sort of ethnic mix in Kosovo? Where does that stand, and how public are those accusations?
You see, Kosovo was a part of Serbia when the NATO bombing started, and Bill Clinton said that the idea was not to take territory or sovereignty away from Serbia, that the idea, in fact, was to prevent a humanitarian tragedy and to stop the ethnic cleansing. So the humanitarian intervention was really like the main rationale for the bombing. However, the bombing caused a huge humanitarian disaster and caused 800,000 people to leave Kosovo and go to Albania and Macedonia. So to Serbs, the purported motive, the stated rationale of Bill Clinton and NATO countries was a fake one. They felt, in one sentence, the Serbs feel that there was no genocide in Kosovo as Bill Clinton had claimed as he started bombing, just like there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Although George Bush had claimed that when he started bombing Iraq.
Although, while I never saw weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, I did visit refugee camps in Albania and Kosovo that, you know, were horrific stories of ethnic cleansing and brutality at the hands of the Serbs once the bombing took place. Do you think that there will ever be peace between Serbia and Kosovo at this point? We just have a few seconds.
Point, there's probably going to be peace.
But a legacy of bitterness certainly comes with that. Liljana Smilovic, former editor of the Serbian daily newspaper Politika, thanks for joining us from the BBC studios in Belgrade, 10 years to the day after NATO bombing began of Serbian territory.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Spring is 5 days old, but wherever you are, how do you know spring is on its way?
It's not my favorite sign of spring, but I know spring's coming with the blossoming of the orange traffic cones on I-95 in Connecticut.
Are you looking at the cones or the crocuses? Tell us your signs of spring at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. We're motivated to think about spring because maybe there's springtime on Wall Street. Whatever you think is the bottom or the end of winter, give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. So did you miss the bubble on the way up? Did you not invest in mortgage-backed securities and actually regretted it maybe at the time when you weren't getting the returns that some of your colleagues and friends were getting? Now, do you feel pretty smart about that decision? While banks in the U.S. and Europe have been bailed out or boarded up, a different scenario has played out in Lebanon. Many banks there are thriving, and the man responsible for bucking the banking trend is Riyad Salameh, governor of Lebanon's central bank. In 2005, he actually prohibited banks in Lebanon from investing in mortgage-backed securities, and today his move seems very prophetic. Governor Salameh joins us to discuss how Lebanon's economy is weathering the global economic meltdown. First of all, Mr. Salameh, congratulations to you.
Thank you. Thank you. And I'm very honored to be on your station.
Well, honored. Forget it. I'm surprised you haven't been hired by Goldman Sachs for having the vision to see beyond the mortgage-backed securities crisis. What was it about the mortgage-backed securities and the temptations of the bubble that caused you to stay away?
Of course, the returns were attractive, and the rating agency had given them a high grade. But we don't see the banking operations being conducted without knowing to whom you are lending your money.
So
these subprimes were created through vehicles with structured financial engineering that was cutting the relation between the lender and the borrower.
So it's as simple as that. If you couldn't look the person who was borrowing in the eye, you didn't want to get involved.
Yes, because banks are responsible, first of all, for the depositor's money. They have to be prudent on how they use this money. And the capital of banks should be used as a hedge for risk. So if you're going to go into risking your capital and leveraging on your balance sheet, therefore using depositors' money, it is a sure thing that when there is a reversal of a trend, whether in real estate or in the stock market, you're going to have heavy setback due to the high leverages you reached. And now, on the other side, you don't know who to address to get back your money.
Now, I totally understand the disconnection between who's the borrower and who's the lender when you have these complicated securities. But, I mean, the rating agencies were saying these were backed in some cases by the U.S. government. The rating agencies suggested to someone like you that there was no risk. How did you resist that?
Well, we were not convinced by the opinion of the rating agencies because it was a departure from our vision of how banking should be conducted. And we were also worried because the same rating agencies giving these rates were also advising on how to structure these products to get to such rating.
It sounds great to me. It occurs to me to ask, how big was your bonus this year, Mr. Salameh?
You know, as a governor, I don't get a bonus, and we have the salary of a governor of a central bank. But
what's that salary? If I might ask, what is that salary?
It's around $200,000 per year.
$200,000. That's your salary. No bonus. You figured out the credit-backed securities problem. You resisted the rating agencies. What can you do now economically in Beirut that maybe some banks in Europe aren't able to do? How has it benefited the Lebanese economy?
Well, the credit operations are continuing normally, which is helping the economy and the growth in the country. We're forecasting a 4% real growth for this year and the rate of inflation below 4%. Lebanon growth is linked to consumption, and therefore the credit continuation of the credit is essential to finance the imports, because we import almost all what we consume here. And it's also important to help the consumers have credit to continue normal and decent life.
I mean, Mr. Salameh, we've got to go, but I just have to say, 4% growth, a solid footing for the bank, a central banker who makes $200,000 a year and doesn't take a bonus. You know, we have much to envy about Lebanon, Mr. Salameh. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Riyad Salameh is the governor of Lebanon Central Bank. He predicted the bubble, predicted its burst. He did not take a bonus and is now forecasting 4% real growth for the nation of Lebanon. Beat that, Mark Garrison, with
hard,
headlines.
Hard to do 28 minutes after the hour. Right now, there are major clashes today in Israel. Those are tear gas canisters you hear firing. Police in riot gear intervene between Israeli far-right activists and Arab Israelis. The far-right activists marched through a northern Israeli town with a mostly Arab population. They were demanding the residents pledge loyalty to Israel. That's a demand of the far-right party, which presumptive Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has on board his coalition. Next hour, Israel's center-left Labor Party will meet to vote on whether to join that coalition. Israeli media reports say they've already got a deal in place. Netanyahu must build a working coalition before he can actually take the office of prime minister. Mexico is upping the ante in its battle to bring down drug cartels. It's offering up to $2 million each for information leading to the arrest of any of a group of top drug kingpins. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton travels to Mexico tomorrow to talk efforts to curb growing drug violence, some of which has spilled over to the U.S. side. President Obama will be talking economic recovery tonight during a primetime news conference. Hot topics such as AIG bonuses, the federal bailout, banks, all of that and more will likely come up. Japan came away the winner for a second time in a row in the World Baseball Classic. It beat bitter rival South Korea 5-3 in the 10th inning. It won't be until 2013 until South Korea or any other country gets another crack at the reigning champions. That's when the next World Baseball Classic takes place. Also, 20 years ago today, one of the worst environmental disasters in history happened just before dawn. That's when the Exxon Valdez hit a reef off the coast of Alaska, spilling some 11 million gallons of oil, killing hundreds of thousands of animals. And actually, the ship itself was repaired and renamed. It actually went back to work, though barred from entering Alaskan waters. And a lot of the oil is still there. The government estimates tens of thousands of it are still in the soil and sand there. So still 20 years later.
20 years. Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Well, the Wall Street groundhogs are back in their hole this morning after a rally yesterday. The Dow's down to more than 1% in the early going on Wall Street. Here we are 5 days into spring. Are we seeing the end of the dark days of winter? How do you know spring is on the way?
My favorite sign of spring is chalk on the sidewalk. It's when we move our living rooms outside and see our neighbors and everything is better.
And for some of you, your rite of spring is a little more risque.
My favorite rite of spring is the showing of more skin. Beautiful women revealing more of themselves is always a beautiful sign that summer is coming.
Well, not likely in New York this morning. 26 degrees when the sun rises. 877-8-MY-TAKE, your favorite sign of spring, or mytake at thetakeaway.org. A study that came out Monday from the Archives of Internal Medicine tracked 500,000 people ranging from middle to old age over 10 years, and the broad public health study, we've been reporting on it all morning, showed that those who ate the equivalent of a hamburger each day were 30% more likely to die during those 10 years. Red meat, possibly hazardous to your health. Joining us to explain more about the study is Barry Popkin, professor of nutrition at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where he heads the Division of Nutritional Epidemiology. He also has an editorial in the journal in question on the subject. Professor, thanks for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
What does this show, and how alarmed should we be about the health implications of red meat?
This study shows essentially that if you were a man between the age of 50 and 70, and there are about 25 million men there, that you would increase your risk by about 25% to 30% of dying if you consumed essentially the equivalent of 5 to 7 ounces of red meat a day. That's about a Whopper. So that if you, and in contrast to people who consumed less than an ounce a day, or that's a Whopper a week. So going from one steak a day or one Whopper a day to once a week would reduce your risk of dying by 25% to 30%. And to put that in real terms, that would mean about 1 million reduced deaths over that 10-year period for those just 50 to 70. That's where we have about 25 million men. The risks are about the same in terms of reduction for women, but there are fewer female deaths during that period, so the numbers aren't quite so stark. But the point is, this is a lot of extra deaths saved. And this is a very well-done study. They controlled for your weight. They controlled for your fruit and vegetable intake, your drinking, your smoking, your supplement use. So this is the additional effect of just consuming red meat.
So they control the variables. So you really do see the implications of red meat versus moderate amounts of red meat once a week, as you say. Let's describe with some specificity what's actually going on in the bodies of the people who ended up dying during the course of the study.
Well, we could speculate on this. We have some idea. Clearly, we understand that the saturated fat in red meat is particularly pernicious for both heart diseases and cancer, particularly colorectal cancer. We also know there's some iron and there's some other substances in red meat. Possibly it's because it's processed and has a lot of other items in them that we don't understand so well today. But the full extent of all the mechanisms aren't truly understood. But there's enough speculation on this that really for 30 to 40 years we've been suggesting and saying people needed to moderate their meat intake. This is the first study that had such careful data on such a large representative sample of people of retirement age, members of AARP, that we can say that it's a little bit more like the Rolls-Royce of studies such as this done in the U.S.
Now, it focused on people of a particular age, as you just mentioned. Is there something particular about age and red meat and saturated fats that is of interest here, or was this population more or less randomly chosen?
This population was a randomly selected population. Of course, there's more death in that age group from heart disease and cancer than there are at younger ages. And the problems at younger ages today are obesity, diabetes, hypertension, and, of course, increasing deaths. But the mortality rates are higher there, so the results are clearer. But we don't have the same kinds of studies with the same numbers in younger ages that I would really be willing to say definitively that the problem would exist in any age. But generally speaking, we recommend the same questions of moderate your red meat intake for all age groups.
And again, I guess the question really is, you know, we're speculating about what it does to the body particularly, but are there qualities to either the fat or the protein in red meat that are fundamentally different from other available sources of these nutrients?
Absolutely there are, but I would hesitate to give the full set of mechanisms because they're not fully understood. But I should add that these results were backed up by a second set of analyses looking at the effects of processed meat. And processed meats are hot dogs, sausages, pepperoni, cold cuts. And that's even more stark. If you consume about an ounce a day of those red meats, those processed meats, that's essentially a hot dog a week, you are going to increase your risk in a comparable manner of death. So that going from eating some processed meat, a hot dog a week, to once a month or to every 2 months will cut the same kind of make the same kind of savings in your long-term health. So the processed meats are a little clearer because we know there's a direct effect not only of the high amounts of saturated fat in those processed meats, but the nitrates and the salts. So for a long time, the World Cancer Research Federation, American Institute of Cancer Research, and other groups have been saying, cut out your processed meats. This study says processed meats affect total deaths, not just colorectal cancer deaths or some limited types of heart disease problems, but total mortality as well.
And it's an amazing study. 500,000 people in middle to old age over 10 years suggest that there's a 30% greater likelihood to die over that time, depending on your intake of red meat. Barry Popkin, professor of nutrition at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, thanks so much for being with us. And Mark Garrison now has some headlines.
Hey, John, how you doing? It's coming up on 21 minutes before
I'm
the hour.
I'm doing fine.
Oh, well, that's good.
I'm
good to know.
Just fine.
We try to determine those things. Next hour, a House panel is set to grill Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner and Fed Chair Ben Bernanke about AIG executive bonuses. The House has passed a bill to slap huge taxes on the payments. A Senate version with the same idea is now on hold. It lacks strong support from the president and has heavy opposition from Republicans. The pair will also get questions on the Hill about the toxic asset plan. President Barack Obama sent a written message to world leaders today to take bold action against the global recession. The message is ahead of the G20 meeting next month in the UK, where leaders of the world's largest economies will be at the table. A federal judge is ordering the FDA make Plan B the morning after a contraceptive pill available to women as young as 17. Right now, they can't get it at that age without a prescription. The judge ruled FDA took political considerations during the Bush administration in setting the minimum age. The ruling says the decision was not grounded in enough sound science. The FDA will now review the ruling. A new car ratings study looks at the strength of roofs in the event of a rollover. The insurance industry rating pegs the Kia Sportage SUV as among the worst for performances. Top scores were the Volkswagen Tiguan, the Subaru Forester, Honda Element, and Jeep Patriot. These are 2009 models, by the way.
This is roofs in the case of a rollover.
Rollover, yeah. So roof strength in terms of rollover.
Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and we have a winner in the World Baseball Classic. It's its own sign of spring, along with spring training in the major leagues. And the final game in the World Baseball Classic has been completed within the last few hours. Jeff Beresford Howe, Takeaway Sports contributor, joins us from Los Angeles. Jeff, we have a winner.
We have a winner, Japan, 5-3.
And tell me about the game. I mean, Japan, of course, they're no stranger to getting into the finals and winning it all here. You know, how did the game proceed, and what were the standouts in the game?
The game was like that Ali Frazier fight in Kinshasa. Japan just kept slugging and slugging and slugging and slugging, and Korea slipped and took the punches the whole game until the 10th inning. They couldn't get past Ichiro. Ichiro is a force of nature, and he came up with a big two-run single and gave Japan the championship.
He plays for the Seattle Mariners, correct?
He does. He's the right fielder for the Mariners.
Right. I know that you're sort of personally involved in the tragedy that happened over the weekend in Oakland. Two cops killed in the course of stopping a motorist in Oakland. You know, I don't know how exactly it's related to you, but I do know that you wanted to mention that this morning.
Yeah, four, actually. Two by pistol and two by assault rifle. Two of the policemen worked security at Oakland A's games and were well-known and well-loved among many people there, including me. The city's devastated. It's a horrifying tragedy.
Well, it's a sad moment to sort of begin the baseball season as we move away from the World Baseball Classic and into the majors this year. Is there anything about the Classic and this game between Japan and South Korea that suggests what might be in store for even, say, Mariners fans going forward?
Well, the thing is, it's a baseball people will tell you that spring training games don't mean very much. Players are still getting ready. They're working on things. And so the short answer is no. There's really nothing about these games that tells you what is going to happen this year. For the future, two young kids, Yu Darvish, a pitcher for Japan, and Artis Chapman, a pitcher for Cuba, burst onto the consciousness of baseball fans with a huge roar. They both throw 100 miles an hour. They both have wicked sliders.
Wow.
They both are trapped in their systems. Darvish in the posting system in Japan, and Chapman in the political system in Cuba. And nobody knows when they're eventually going to hit the major leagues. But they were spectacular to watch, and they're going to eventually be very, very wealthy young men in the United States.
Well, Jeff, is that ultimately what the entertainment value is becoming of the World Baseball Classic, particularly for American baseball watchers? A kind of a talent scout? Everyone can be a scout for the majors and watching some of these players that we would never see?
Yeah, we got to see a lot of guys who we never would see. The real revelation for a lot of baseball fans was the Korean team. Only one guy on the Korean team is in the major leagues. There is no reason why some enterprising general manager for one of the bottom feeders in Major League Baseball shouldn't fire their entire team and bring in the Korean
right.
team and play for a year. I think that team could make the playoffs.
Or even the team from Denmark, right?
The Netherlands.
The Netherlands, right. Netherlands. I mean, they were crazy in the beginning. Last time we talked, it was Netherlands over Cuba, right?
The Dominicans. They beat
the Dominicans
twice.
That's right.
It was truly extraordinary. But a lot of those kids are in the minor leagues.
Right.
And most of the Korean players aren't even in the minor leagues.
Netherlands, Koreans. We can all be talent scouts watching the World Baseball Classic. Jeff Beresford Howe, thanks so much for being with us.
Okay.
Jeff Beresford Howe, Takeaway Sports contributor in L.A., watching the World Baseball Classic, Japan over Korea, 5-3 in 10.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. All those fickle investors on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down about 100. They're taking profits this morning. Are we seeing the end of the dark days of winter? Can we look forward to some spring sunshine? How do you know spring's on the way?
Hi, this is Jessica from South Carolina. I know spring is here when my eyes start watering and my nose starts running and I see my car covered in pollen.
Tell us your signs of spring at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. In a moment, what's going to restart bank lending? We'll talk to the governor of New Jersey right after Mark Garrison gives us the headlines.
Thank you, John. Coming up on 12 minutes before the hour, a 17-year-old is charged with the murder of a policeman in Northern Ireland earlier this month. Police say he's a member of a splinter group of the IRA called Continuity IRA. That group took responsibility for the killing. No one has been charged in connection with another recent attack. A different IRA splinter group claimed responsibility for killing two British soldiers earlier this month. We're talking signs of spring today, but across Wyoming and several other plain states, a blizzard has shut down hundreds of miles of interstate highway. Forecasters say the storm could dump up to 40 inches in some mountainous regions. And in just a few minutes, a House panel is bringing in Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner and Fed Chair Ben Bernanke to talk about the AIG payouts. The House passed a bill to slap huge taxes on the payments. There is a similar bill in the Senate, but it's on hold due to a lack of support from the president and opposition from Republicans. John?
Thank you. AIG is off the table, at least for some in the investment community. Secretary of the Treasury Tim Geithner outlined his plan yesterday to save the banking system, to bail out the banking system, and it involves some a mix of money. Public money, also private money. It's kind of a three-part program. The FDIC puts up some money. The Federal Treasury, the so-called TARP Fund, puts up some money. And also a certain amount of private money by questionable, toxic, so-called assets in bank portfolios. And that's all to bring the bank balance sheets back to health and at least help them to lend and allow credit to flow in the economy. But to actually put up the private capital and to help keep these banks, to help these banks out are people like John Corzine, governor of New Jersey. He's responsible for pulling some of those levers. He's the former president of Goldman Sachs, but as a governor of New Jersey, he's in control of pension funds, which would be a part of the private sector money, conceivably to be a part of these investment portfolios. Governor, $330 billion is what the Treasury says it is hoping to get from the private sector in this whole investment program. Any chance they could tempt you to get in on the action here?
Well, first of all, we have an investment board that oversees a independent investment division inside our Treasury Department that will make the ultimate decision. I have to say that I think the plan is sensible if the banks are willing to sell the so-called toxic securities or toxic loans. Those are two different pools of assets that banks own. If they're willing to sell them at rough market prices that reflect the credit losses that exist in those assets, then I think it could be a very good investment. And the uniqueness of the program that Treasury Secretary Geithner and the folks put down was that the prices are going to be determined by market participants, not edicted by Treasury or demanded by only the seller. It has to be the market deciding that the value of those toxic assets is whatever it is.
All right, well, then there's three considerations here, and you've outlined them actually very articulately. Number one, the private money is going to set the price here, at least in theory. Mm-hmm. What prices are people such as your investment board looking for to get these assets, and what sort of yield or spread on those investments do you think is possible at the other end?
Well, first of all, each asset has its own value depending on they're not all the same. They're not fungible. They don't look the same. One is a loan against a building in Hoboken, and another is a loan against a building or houses in California. So they'll all have different characteristics associated with them. But those assets need to be priced at 40 cents on the dollar or 60 cents on the dollar, depending on how they're going to get paid back. The people who do this for a living, and there are a number of investment management firms that are going to be involved in this program that are going to evaluate the underlying loan, put the price on it, then they'll go out and collect investors, including people like the state of New Jersey, if they choose to join this investment group, and bring that money to bear. One case, when it's loans, the FDIC will guarantee a portion of the money that's put in. In the case of the other, the Treasury will guarantee if it's securities. And prices will be all over the ballpark. Some places it'll be 80 cents on the dollar. Some it might be as low as 20 cents.
So it's a time-consuming process. But how important are the federal guarantees? Is it eliminate risk or does it minimize risk?
It minimizes risk. What it's going to do is take the worst case off the table where you would never recover any cents on the dollar. And if those assets were misjudged or mispriced by the groups that go in and buy them, there is a downside insurance policy, if you want to call it that, of a minimum amount that would be returned to the investor, and the Treasury would lose that. And then the Treasury also, Treasury and the FDIC, will experience part of the profit benefit if the price of the asset goes from 60 cents back up to a dollar.
Well, let's talk about the profit side. On the upside here, does New Jersey and other investors stand to get a windfall here, or is this more a patriotic exercise, kind of like buying a savings bond where you do one for the team?
I would say it's more, John, a market return. You're taking risk. You have some potential for losses. You have some potential for gain. If the people in the marketplace price this asset right, you'll get a fair market return for the risk that you're taking. And I think that's why the marketplace actually liked this program in concept yesterday. It has one big question mark on it.
Right.
Will the banks sell the assets at the price that the market says they should be sold at? It's always been a problem with the so-called toxic assets. Would the banks be willing to sell at 40 cents on the dollar or 60 cents on the original dollar that they put into these loans? And if they're not, then, you know, it's a nice plan, but it doesn't work because they're not actually eliminating the securities from their portfolio and therefore freeing up cash to be making other loans.
Well, then from your perspective, last question here, if they don't reach that $330 billion or $300 billion in private money, and again, this isn't like a Treasury auction, it's much more complex.
Right.
But if they don't reach that $330, what's the market verdict on that? That basically the banks are backing away?
I think that we will continue to have a clogged up banking system. It will have been a very effectual try, and I think the markets think that it may very well work, or they would not have reacted as so positively as they did yesterday. But it still remains to be seen whether, say, Citicorp, which has a lot of toxic assets, is willing to sell at the price that the market thinks they should be priced at, those loans that they have taken on or the securities they've bought. And so that's going to be the big, big question. If they are willing to sell, then I think we're on to a very good program. You'll get your $330 billion. You might even get more out of the private sector. And I think we could see a positive turn with regard to our financial system, and that therefore underlies a very positive outcome for the economy over a longer period of time.
Well, Governor, I thank you so much for that briefing. So just very quickly, if the banks are willing to sell at the lower prices, you would actually recommend this to people with pensions as a good investment for their pension money?
As long as they're working with people that know how to price the assets. You have to have somebody that knows what a loan backed by a building in Hoboken costs versus a package of house mortgages in California. You have to have somebody that knows the details of how to price the assets.
So, Governor Corzine, thanks so much for joining us. Governor of New Jersey, former CEO and chairman of Goldman Sachs, talking about the possible consideration to use pension funds, state pension funds, for the bank bailout plan announced yesterday by Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner. You really see what's at stake there. And last week, we asked you to rebrand the company AIG. We asked for your suggestions for what the letters AIG stood for. Well, the company might be listening because they're now announcing that they're going to pick a new name for the company. Your suggestions kept coming in over the last few days, so we thought we'd play a few more suggestions for AIG executives to listen to.
I've looked at AIG's business model. I've given a lot of thought, and I've decided that it has to be renamed Alligators Ingesting Garbage.
AIG should stand for Accomplices in Grime.
An ignominious giant.
AIG, all investments gone.
It's safe to say AIG won't be taking any of your suggestions, but keep them coming at 877-8-MY-TAKE. All this morning, we're talking about seeing the end of the economic winter. What are the signs of spring?
Hi, this is Andrea in Augusta, Georgia, and one of the first signs of spring here is the Tickets Wanted signs that sprout up all over town for the Masters Tournament.
Your signs at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Todd Zwillick, take us out.
Even if they get this budget passed, that doesn't mean we have a cap-and-trade system. It doesn't mean we have a health care overhaul. It just means they have the running room to make the policy.
Chasing budget dollars down the corridors on Capitol Hill, that's Todd Zwillick. I'm John Hockenberry, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.